From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Emily Dickinson was a great poet, yes, but she was also an accomplished gardener and a devoted student of the natural world. An all-new edition of a book on Emily as a gardener, titled Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life, is just out, and from it we get not just her history, but a slice of horticultural history, plus a charming palette of plants for a poet's garden. More in a moment, but first this message.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, made possible from Time Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners, farmers, and homesteaders with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/Away to Garden.
Author Marta McDowell, a gardener and landscape designer in contemporary New Jersey, has a particular passion for digging into noted authors and their gardens, and has written books on Beatrix Potter, Laura Ingalls Wilder, and now a fully revised version of her popular one on Emily Dickinson. So I should say that with the transcript of the show on awaytogarden.com, we'll have a book giveaway, of course, and the book is beautiful. I've been enjoying it. Are you happy with it?
I am. I think it really came out nicely.
Yeah, it did. I was actually showing it to a friend today, and she was fascinated. She didn't know anything about Emily as a gardener. So, why, you know, I think this was a topic that you had covered in 2005 in your book called Emily Dickinson's Gardens, and the publisher asked you to do it again, or what was the reason that it's coming out now in a new version?
Well, that is the way it happened.
Yeah.
The original book's been out of print for a really long time.
Ah.
And so Timber Press said, you know, would you like to bring it out again? And I thought, wow, I get a second chance. You know, I get a redo. How often does that happen?
In life or in books?
Especially in life.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, this was kind of my... You know, it was the way I came into writing. So for me to be able to, you know, fix it, change it, and especially add color, you know, and add a lot in terms of illustrations to support it was really a gift.
So for people who maybe don't know the time period of Emily's life, she was born and lived in Amherst, Massachusetts, and born in 1830, and I think she lived till 1886. But no books of her poems were published till after her death. Is that correct?
It's true. So only about a dozen of her poems came out during her lifetime. And they were, you know, sort of here and there, newspapers. One of them appeared in a book anonymously. And it's not known whether she ever really approved of those.
Mm-hmm.
But she did save all of her poems. She wrote something like 1,800 of them and bound a lot of them in these hand-sewn books that were all in her cherry chest when she died.
Mm.
So that's when, you know, after her death, when these were discovered, that's when people got interested in editing them and putting them out.
So in the intro of the new book, you say that most of us will, you know, when we think of Emily Dickinson, we'll think of that famous daguerreotype image. It's a 16-year-old Emily sort of staring out at us. And we may have heard stories of her as kind of hermit-like, almost reclusive. I don't know. But who is she really most of all, do you think, having done all this research and written this book?
Well, she's certainly a gifted writer. But for me, the entree was the fact that she was, you know, in fact, when I studied Emily Dickinson in school, I kind of, you know, a lot of the poems I would go, huh? You know, like, what?
Yeah.
And then, you know, I just by chance visited the museum one day, I think it was in the 90s, and found out she was a gardener, and I was a gardener, and it was like a little, you know, light bulb.
Yes.
Went off, you know, everything was illuminated.
Yes.
And, you know, that's where this started, to say, let me find out what she knew and what she grew and how that informed some of her poems. And that was really a way into her poetry for me.
Yes. I love, there's a quote in the book, I think it's from a letter she wrote to someone, and she says, "I'm from the fields, you know, and while quite at home with the dandelion, make but sorry figure in a drawing room." More at home in nature, the girl was, yeah?
She was, although she was also kind of a, you know, like she would adopt these poses, right?
Mm-hmm.
So one person met Emily Dickinson. He eventually edited her poems. His name was Thomas Wentworth Higginson. There's a New England name for you.
Uh-huh.
And he, you know, they had corresponded, and he finally went and met her in Amherst. And so he's in the drawing room at their house, and she comes in and presents him with two daylilies and says, "These are my introduction." I mean, he later wrote his wife that night and said, "I've never been so exhausted by a conversation with anyone."
Right, right. So she wasn't really totally retiring. she had presence for sure.
Yes, and not, you know, she was connected with a lot of people through correspondence as well. So sometimes I think, wow, she was like the Lady Gaga of the 19th century.
So back in the Victorian era, women's areas of study and vocation were more limited, but botany was kind of considered okay, right?
Yes, it was considered something just very fitting for females,
mm-hmm.
right? It was something beautiful. The flowers were something that could be enjoyed out in nature, so it was healthful. And, you know, you kind of couldn't get in trouble with flowers.
Right.
Even if you dissected them.
Right. Right. And she made, besides the hand-sewn together books of poems that were found after her death, she pressed flowers and made herbarium, herbaria, herbariums, whatever. She made books of pressed flowers as well, labeled and identified and as well, didn't she?
Yeah, so a herbarium, right, it's not something that most of us nowadays think about creating.
Mm-hmm.
But in her day, it was a really popular hobby. I don't know exactly what to compare it to. You know, like how all of a sudden now everybody's making pickles?
Yes.
Right, in her day, everybody was making their herbarium. You know, she writes to her friends with little leaves and flowers, and, you know, "Have you made a herbarium yet?"
Mm-hmm.
And she was very enthusiastic about it. It's not clear for how long. We know that she continued to keep specimens well into adulthood, but she certainly had this 60-plus page album that is just jammed with plants.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the pages, and I've included some of them, they're really quite beautiful. They're artistic in their own way. You know, this was part of her material culture, right? So she's taking these flowers, she's looking at them clearly with a magnifying glass because she's counting the number of flower parts, the number of pistils and stamens. She's writing out the botanical Latin, which she kind of abandons in later life. She doesn't really use the scientific names, but she was doing it then.
Mm-hmm. So you say
and she was doing it with both wildflowers and with garden plants.
Right.
So that also gives lots of clues as to what was growing then.
Right. And the family place in Amherst, it was kind of a homestead. In fact, I think it was called the homestead or whatever. It was there was more going on than just what she was gardening or interested in. Her passion was the flower garden, was it? I mean, was that a particular passion of hers?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, the flower garden, and she also writes a lot about the orchard. But the Dickinson place was big, right? It was 3 acres on one side of the street and almost a 10-acre meadow on the other. So
mm-hmm.
it included kind of mini farm. Lots of vegetables, there was livestock, and then this big meadow, which, you know, would have been used for some grazing and haying, but also neighbors talked about it just being full of bees and butterflies, and she
right.
talked so much about pollinators and birds and things.
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned that, she was a real nature person, and you know, you have quotes in the book. She says, "I was always attached to mud." She was always in it, right? And you know,
yes,
yeah, and you know, so many of her poems start with a line, you know, "Hope is the thing with feathers," the famous one, and "I heard a fly buzz when I died," and then there's that one that you just said, "Bird." It reminds me of the one, "A bird came down the walk."
Yes.
A bird came down the walk. He did not know I saw. He bit an angleworm in halves and ate the fellow raw. You know, she's observing these little things that are so fantastic, and yet nobody stands still long enough to notice them, let alone set them to poetry. And, you know, that's what I loved about
Absolutely.
Her. Yeah, yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, she'll take something very, you know, kind of common to all of us. Okay, the rose. And she talks about them as pygmy seraphs gone astray, you know, like some angel has fallen to earth.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's like her language really clutches your heart.
Right. So in that flower garden, you know, kind of, well, first of all, what were the sort of it plants that a gardener of her day would have craved or sought after? I mean, were there things that you're aware of that were the... You know, we have them now, but of our own. But what were some of the ones that she would have wanted that would have been triumphs to acquire or to grow?
Well, certainly lilies.
Uh-huh.
She loved lilies. And she got from a friend, sent her lilies. You know, this would be as if, you know, you sent me a package of lilies. And what she writes back to this friend is, "I've long been a lunatic on bulbs." The lunacy on any theme is better undivulged.
Yeah.
Right? You know, it's like, it would have been so interesting to be a correspondent with her. So lilies, definitely roses, lots and lots of roses. And she called herself Daisy sometimes.
Oh. You
know, she kind of used that as a stand-in for herself.
Uh-huh. Huh.
So...
I was
lots of things, lots of annuals, lots of perennials too.
I was startled to see some of the summer annuals that you include in one section of the book. For instance, you know, and some of them are things that I think were in for a while when I began gardening decades ago, and then have had a resurgence again. So things that, but here they were. For instance, Gomphrena. You know, what do they? I can't remember what the. The
globe flower.
Globe flower, right.
Right. So she grew globe flower or globe amaranth.
Globe amaranth, right.
And it's it's that round, bouncy thing,
yeah.
And you can dry them and they'll retain their color. And I think in those days, because I found several examples of dried flowers in the herbarium, and I think, you know, you couldn't as easily go to, I don't know, the grocery store or the florist and get fresh flowers. So for the winter, you'd want to have dried arrangements.
Mm-hmm.
And so things like this globe amaranth, you could dry from the summer, and then it could adorn your house in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things were very practical. Some of the things are kind of unusual annuals that are grown for fragrance, like mignonette.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to find it. You can buy the seed, but it was really, it's a very sort of inconspicuous little flower, although butterflies like it.
Yes.
Because the fragrance is very intense, so it must have a lot of nectar in it. Again, things that you wouldn't necessarily find nowadays.
Right. And was there symbolism in some of these for her? I mean, like, you know, you're saying these everlastings, you know, like the Gomphrena. I mean...
And she certainly writes about eternity.
Like
right?
Immortality, right? Well, yeah, right? I mean, yeah, eternity.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think there were also these kind of Garden of Eden kind of connections. She was very well-read. Certainly a lot of contemporary literature, contemporary for her. She loved Elizabeth Barrett Browning. She absolutely loved George Eliot. She talks about reading Jane Austen. And, you know, so she was getting a lot of influences from different places, but she also really knew her Shakespeare and the Bible. And so she often talks about her garden as Eden, or, you know, her place as Eden,
huh.
or her place as paradise.
Huh.
And so I think some things, you know, also had that twist to them as well.
Huh. So if we kind of, was she a daring gardener? Because when I think at one point in the book you talk about her figs, she grew figs, and I mean, she was in Amherst, Massachusetts. That surprised me. Was she daring? And tell us about her figs, first of all. How in the world did she do that?
Well, the figs were actually her mother's
figs. Oh, okay.
I don't know if we can really give Emily Dickinson, her mother's name was also Emily.
Oh.
So it wasn't Emily Elizabeth Dickinson, it was Emily Norcross Dickinson. But mm-hmm. the figs, you know, were certainly around, and she certainly uses the terms in terms of, you know, I don't give a fig for Jenny Lind, who
yeah.
was a singer.
Yeah.
But her mother cultivated them. They were in a position near this big barn, so it must have been a sheltered place. But whether they covered them, which you certainly do down here in New Jersey,
yes.
or buried them, which was also a fairly common practice for the winter, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that her mother would have baskets of ripe figs and even bring them down to the newspaper office because the local newspapers would report on this.
Wow. It's kind of wonderful because here we are, you know, this many years later, and one of the popular topics that people like to ask each other about who live in a northern location is, can you grow a fig? So we're all still wrestling with the same the same things.
Yes, and I have to confess that I am basically a fig failure.
Yeah, it's tough.
You know, I keep trying, but,
yeah.
you know, if I get a couple of figs, I feel that I've had a great success.
Yeah. So if we wanted to make a garden, if we wanted to be inspired by her, you mentioned, you know, we mentioned the Gomphrenas, you mentioned Mignonette. I remember there was, I think what now we call it Centauria or whatever, but Amber Aboa, was that what it was called then? You know, what do you imagine would be some of the, in homage to her, inspired by her, what would be some of the other lilies and roses you said, but what are some of the other things that would be in a garden today?
Well, at the Dickinson Museum, we plant a lot of things. Well, we try to plant only things, actually, that she mentioned.
Okay.
So in the spring, it's various kinds of violets and lots of primroses, bulbs and bulbs, snowdrops, daffodils, crocus, tulips, if you don't have deer, hyacinths.
Right.
Again, you know, daisies, foxgloves. She wrote about lilacs. You know, if you just want to try some shrubs, do some lilacs. Do, again, roses. Hope you don't have deer. dahlias, chrysanthemums, zinnias, marigolds. She loved the color purple. Anything purple.
Oh, purple was her thing. Oh, interesting.
Purple was her thing. Nasturtium, sweet peas. You know, there's a huge list. That was part of my fun, was compiling a list for the
right.
back of this
in the back of the book. There, it's almost like a chart, and it tells you know, the characteristics of each plant, its common and Latin name, and where the plant shows up in her writing, as well as a description of the plant and whether it's native or not native, right? And that goes on for pages and pages. So yeah, she certainly
yes, this is what I do in my spare time.
But she certainly tried a lot of plants. I mean, you know, she certainly was into it. That's for sure.
The amazing thing to me is also how many wild plants she was aware of that appear in her poems, letters, and the herbarium. You know, if you think about the normal person nowadays and how many wild flowers they've actually encountered and could name, you know, it's a much smaller number, I think.
Well, I think people are currently oblivious, really. And the study of botany that was encouraged even for young women of the day is not only not encouraged for young women of today, but is pretty much not encouraged for any. I mean, it's not really something that you hear about people saying, oh, yeah, I'm taking botany. Do you know what I mean? In the course of a normal high school curriculum, for instance, or you know, around that age or a little older, you don't hear about it.
Yeah, it's much more unusual. Again, it was just the common thing then that everybody would have been walking around looking for flowers as opposed to walking around looking at their phones.
Right, exactly. Now, in this doing this new version of a book that you first did, a similar book in 2005, there was new scholarship available probably to pore over and so forth, but were there any like, oh my goodness, you know, like discoveries that you were so excited to make in the last couple of minutes? Did any come to mind from then to now?
I think the most fun for me was really getting to go through the local newspapers. Unfortunately, the Amherst newspapers are not available in any of the, like, newspapers.com or, you know, any of those things online. You have to still go to the Amherst Public Library and sit on a microfilm machine.
I was going to say, let's go to the microfilm, oh boy.
Right, and it wasn't easy, but it was fun because you could see the nurseries that she had access to. You know, we know that they bought plants from different places, but I was able to, like, find local advertisements for these businesses and what were they selling, and to see, well, when did the agricultural college open and when were the glass houses put in, you know, what's now the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, originally the ag school.
Yes.
And what were the, you know, the local fairs like? You know, it's like right in Amherst, they had the equivalent of like a county fair where people would bring their plants and flower arrangements and baking. You know, she was a baker, and you could see, oh, you know, how were things judged? Who was judging? You know, who in her family were on the judging panels? So that was just so much fun.
So to, in a way, recreate a context for the sort of bigger picture of the world that she was living in, sounds like fun. That does sound like fun, kind of doing that forensic investigating, albeit on microfilm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not the easy way. It's much better to have full text search. Don't get me wrong.
Sure. No, I know. Well, the book is Emily Dickinson's Gardening Life by Marta McDowell. Marta, congratulations, and thank you so much. And I'm glad you dug into her history again, because it is fascinating, and I loved, especially as I said, seeing some of the plants that I thought were, you know, old but new again, but I didn't realize how old they were, that they'd even been in her gardens that long ago. So very, very interesting. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure, Margaret.
Talk to you soon.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach, made possible from Time-Owing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners, farmers, and homesteaders with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/A Way to Garden.
And I hope I'll talk to all the rest of you soon again. Now, don't miss an episode. Find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or on Facebook or Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.